It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. Today I want to share with you a conversation I had with a remarkable couple. Justin and Wella Jay met in Anchorage while serving in the Army. They were both deployed to combat in Afghanistan. They both came back with trauma from their wartime experiences. But as a couple, they supported each other and found a way to walk off the war on a six-month hike over the Appalachian Trail from Georgia to Maine. I really enjoyed getting to know them, and I think you will too. And what they have to say could be of a lot of value to other veterans in our community who could use nature as therapy, as they did. Then later on the show, staying on the theme of outdoor adventures outside Alaska, we have a weird and funny story produced some time ago by Scott Carrier, who went to Hawaii to learn to surf and got a bigger lesson than he bargained for. And to finish today's show, a story about an Alaskan's ill-fated attempt to climb the tallest mountain in Africa. It's Outdoor Explorer, this week with stories from outside Alaska. Stay with us. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and I'm really excited about my next guests. They have just done a pretty impressive hike, the entire Appalachian Trail, which runs the whole of the eastern seaboard from Maine down to, I guess, where does it end?
Georgia, yeah, North Georgia.
Yeah, that's a long way. And they did it as part of what's called nature therapy, that is, dealing with traumas that they experienced and the past that they went through serving in Afghanistan in the military. And they're a couple, and they're from here in Anchorage. And they just want to tell about that experience and also about the benefit that other veterans could probably get from getting outdoors and sort of taking this different approach. And I want to thank you both for being here, Justin and Wella Jay. Thanks for being on Outdoor Explorer with us.
Thank you. Yeah,
thanks for having us.
So let's start by talking about your adventure and then sort of get a little bit more into like why you wanted to do it. Mm-hmm. The Appalachian Trail is like, it's a wonderful challenge that is like, it's a huge, I mean, it's going to take a long time. And you guys like took a whole, you know, months to do it, right?
Oh yeah, 6 months.
Yeah, yeah. So where did you start?
So we started down in Georgia on March the 17th.
Okay. Yeah. And started heading north.
Yeah, started walking north. And then, it took roughly right about 6 months for us to complete it. We ended up in May. And usually that's the traditional route. People go from Georgia to Maine because that's how it was completed, actually, by the first through hiker who was a veteran walking off the war.
Oh, really?
Earl Schaefer, specifically.
Huh.
So,
and that would have been like World War II, right?
Exactly. Yeah. He was walking off World War II. And that's traditionally been how everyone else does it. You can also go southbound,
sure,
from Maine to Georgia, but we chose to do the traditional route, and that was a fantastic experience.
Yeah.
A long walk for sure.
Well, had you ever done anything like that before?
No, I had not gone any long distance hikes before, so Justin was a little bit more experienced.
Uh-huh.
And having grown up in Tennessee and Georgia, he knew a lot about the Appalachian Trail and was the one that actually introduced me to the trail. But after hearing about Earl Schaefer's story and learning more about the Appalachian Trail, we were both definitely intrigued.
Uh-huh.
And then Justin found out about Warrior Expeditions, which I think we'll talk a little,
yeah,
bit more about later,
yeah,
on. And it was just a wonderful opportunity that allowed us to take 6 months and spend it in the woods, which was awesome.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not all, I mean, it's a beautiful country to hike through, but it's not all easy, right? Especially when you're out there for 6 months. I mean, that's
no,
a lot of rain. That's a lot of hot, yeah, heat. That's a lot of bugs. I mean, what were some of the challenges you ran into?
Well, I think some of the challenges that we had, obviously it's difficult walking up and down mountains all day. Let's see, the hardest thing, oh man.
I think, so the first 2 months of our hike, it rained almost nonstop.
Oh, wow.
And yes, getting used to that was certainly an adjustment. We went into town every 3 to 5 days, and it's one thing walking in the rain for one day, but then doing it for 5 days on end where you have wet clothes and wet socks and wet shirts to get into, mm-hmm, that was a little bit of an adjustment.
Yeah.
And I think going on a hike for a weekend is certainly fun, but when you're doing it for 6 months, it turns into almost a job.
Yeah, it turns, yeah, into work a little bit, because, I mean, there's days where you wake up and
you just don't want to.
Yeah. Like your body's in pain. And
yeah.
Yeah,
you know,
for sure. How many miles did you try to cover every day?
So we averaged about, if you took all the miles and you divided it by the days that we ended up hiking, I think it was 12 miles a day. However, we would shoot for about 15 miles a day because we took an approach where we found that if we were more consistent and we did lower miles, we were better off because mm-hmm. you kind of have this tortoise and the hare approach that some people take where you've got the hare that they'll jam out 30 miles and they have to take 2 days off. Whereas if you just stay consistent, yeah. you know, you don't take as many 0 days, which is a day where you don't do any hiking at all. You still cover the same amount of ground, and it's just better that way. Yeah. It's better on your body.
Yeah. We certainly notice benefits, too, after the hike. A lot of people have long-term injuries or plantar fasciitis, yeah. and I think our bodies recovered pretty well, and we didn't mm-hmm. seem to have any long-term effects.
To me, it's the idea of wearing a pack for 6 months. Like, yeah. like, you know, when you take your pack off and you feel like you're floating? Uh-huh. I mean, after 6 months of that, I think you'd be like going up to the stratosphere. Yeah. I mean, your body really changes over that amount of time, right? I mean,
oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, it's incredible what our bodies will adapt to the job that you're trying to perform. Mm-hmm. And it was so cool to see that as we kept hiking that suddenly it was like, oh, well, we could do 20 miles today. And it wasn't such a big deal. We knew we'd be a little bit tired at the end of the day, but yeah. it was still manageable. Whereas that is something that would be completely unthinkable in regular day-to-day life for us. So
yeah.
we were pretty excited about yeah. that.
And mentioning what you just said about taking off your pack, so there is something on the trail called slack packing, and that is when you have someone that you know, and usually they call them trail angels, so someone that you meet along the way that's uh-huh. willing to help you out, that might hold your pack for a day and allow you to cover a certain distance without your full pack, and uh-huh. it certainly felt like we were floating along the trail mm-hmm. during that time.
Nice.
Which is amazing.
All right, so that's we've established that you did this really cool trip, which now I'm like feeling super envious for. But you had a you had a purpose for doing this, and it goes back to Afghanistan. You both served in Afghanistan, and I guess you both met here in Anchorage.
That's correct.
Yeah,
Fort Richardson.
Serving at Fort Richardson, so you're in the Army, and then off to serve our country overseas. So. I guess you went first, right, Bella?
Yeah, so I deployed in 2013 under a program called the Cultural Support Team. And basically what that was is a program that was established to see if women could work along special operations, so any type of special forces, rangers, in any branch of service. And the idea was at that time, women were not supposed to be working alongside those teams just yet. And we also had a special role where culturally speaking, in Afghanistan, it's not appropriate to have American men or foreign men speaking to the women and children, but oftentimes they do have a lot of knowledge about the going-ons in their villages.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the role that I had during my deployment, I was together with another female soldier and a female interpreter, and we went on the missions with a team that we were attached to and were allowed to talk to women and children during these missions and try to gather any information that our American service members, the male service members, needed to help target anyone that they were looking for specifically.
So these would be like ranger units that you're out with, or something like that?
Yeah, I worked primarily with Marine Special Operations and Army Special Operations, but there were also rangers for other women.
Huh. That sounds pretty challenging and pretty scary.
It was certainly challenging. I think there was a lot of exposure to things that you just might not see on an everyday basis in the United States.
Yeah.
And my role as a woman there was never, wasn't supposed to be firing my weapon or everything. I was there to gather information primarily, but you still are exposed to a very different culture,
mm-hmm.
And maybe put in situations that you wouldn't see when you're in the United States on an everyday basis.
Yeah.
So I certainly had a lot to think about when I came back and a lot of readjusting to do. And going on a hike was the perfect opportunity
yeah.
to kind of work through everything that we had experienced during that
yeah.
time.
So you guys did not go simultaneously. You went later, right, Justin?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. And so what was your role over there?
So I was the executive officer for a forward surgical team. And a forward surgical team was the Army's way of putting surgical assets far forward. So they did a little bit of research and found within the first hour of an injury, so like a gunshot wound, that is when that patient has the greatest opportunity to respond well to care. So what they wanted to do was get surgical assets right there at the far front of the line. So we were embedded with an infantry unit, and the point was to get from point of injury, they wanted to get that patient to us within that hour. So we would do stabilization surgery and then get them to the next asset. And my role on that was to really coordinate from point of injury to make sure that they were evacuated back to us properly, and then make sure that the evacuation assets were there once the surgery was complete and the patient was stable, and then get them to the next higher role of care, whether that's, you know, the next big base or even back to Germany.
Mm-hmm. So that's pretty hairy work, because you're pretty close to the front mm-hmm. of the action, and you're dealing with pretty serious injuries coming in all the time.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And a dangerous place to be, right?
Like I said, it wasn't safe.
I mean, but it goes without saying in one sense, but also just as we think about our everyday lives, we don't think about being near combat all the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a heavy thing on your psyche, I would think.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you're concerned with just day-to-day operations, and then you've got that added asset, but we always felt pretty safe. We've got a lot of faith in our infantry unit, so we're very happy to be there with them and very thankful for their security as well.
So now as a couple, I mean, the typical thing is one member of the team, usually the male, goes over and the wife stays behind or something, or could be the other way around. Pretty unusual to have both members of a couple go to the same part of the world, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, in that sense, I would think you'd be able to support each other in a way that others might not be able to. True?
Oh, absolutely. That was probably, and I don't think I appreciated that quite until I came back from my deployment, because, well, I had already known what it was like, and mm-hmm. she made the transition just so much better for me. I mean, it was just simple stuff like labeling where everything is in our kitchen with a label maker, and that helped immensely.
And to explain why that would be necessary.
Well, because you come home and it's a little bit difficult because you both have figured out a way to live without each other for 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
So you're really, truly learning each other again.
It's readapting. Yeah.
You're learning your house again. Like, nothing's familiar to what mm-hmm. you were doing for 9 months, because overseas I would wake up, brush my teeth, shave, take a quick Navy shower of about 30 seconds,
mm-hmm.
and then go about work in a completely different way than I would here. And you get used to that. And when you come back, everything's completely different. So
I think that can also cause a lot of friction, when you're used to being independent and then coming back to this new environment. And then the other thing is, I think what you experience during deployment kind of changes how you see the world and how you interact in the world. And there's some frustrations that you might have from deployment. For example, I know when both of us came back from deployment after having seen, either experienced firefights or been in a situation where we've lost loved ones and close friends and experienced or witnessed a lot of trauma, then your level of urgency changes a lot. So what is important in life changes a lot versus what might be important here. So, for example, what is important is someone bleeding out or not? Are they alive or not? That is, mm-hmm. that's what's an emergency. Versus over here, an emergency might be, do I have Wi-Fi or don't I?
I lost my ID, right,
So having, for both of us, having a spouse that understands what the level of urgency is and that we might not complain about certain things can really help the transition, I think.
I imagine, because you hear from veterans, I came home and nobody understood me. But in your case, you could understand.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I'm talking with Justin and Willa Jay, who both served in the U.S. Army in Afghanistan, and then came back home and dealing with that experience through nature and being outdoors. And came in to talk about that. It maybe help other folks who have been through some of these traumatic experiences also figure out how to deal with them, in a way that's positive. So really, really grateful that they're here. And the show is Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. So you came home first, Wella, and Justin hadn't been yet. So your coming home experience was a little bit different from his, yes?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes and no. So fortunately, since we were both in the military, I think we had a similar mindset, mm-hmm. a similar working environment, so I think that helped a lot. Mm-hmm. And after I came back from deployment, I had an opportunity to go on a shorter version of a retreat that incorporated some nature therapy, which had really helped me. And then we spent a lot of time outdoors, living in Alaska, as mm-hmm. most people do,
yeah.
which I think helped both of us. And Justin was always very supportive open to listening to my experiences and some of the struggles that I was going through. And yeah. I couldn't have asked for a more supportive spouse during that time.
Well, talk a little bit about what those struggles are, because I think we can kind of imagine, but not really, you know, those of us who haven't been over there, sort of what the what you go through and then what you need to adjust to in coming back.
Okay.
I know, that's a tough, big question, but...
I'm trying to, see how to break it down best, and I'm sure Justin can help me through it as well.
I mean, you've talked about, like, the change, like, you're no longer in danger, and that sort of the things that you were dealing with, which were big and terrifying, are no longer there, and so maybe the life sort of is hard, feels less significant in some way when you come back. But then there's also just the trauma of being through bad experiences and trying to get to where you're not thinking about that all the time, right? I mean, is that part of it?
Yes. I think one of the things that I struggled with was when you're in a combat situation of any type, you're trained to see everyone that you don't know closely as the enemy. Mm-hmm. And because you're trying to protect yourself and you're trying to protect your team. So then when you come back into a quote-unquote safe environment, it's really hard to not see everyone as the enemy, even though you're not doing that consciously. It's more subconsciously done.
Right.
But it causes one to have a more pessimistic outlook on pretty much everything.
Sort of be on guard all the time.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's even something that we were aware of until we went on our hike. But maybe mm-hmm. Justin can speak a little bit more.
Same thing for you, Justin?
Absolutely. It's really hard to kind of turn it off once you get home. That suspicion that you have of just everything. Like, you're looking at everything with a critical eye. Like, oh, what's that, you know, that weird box doing there? Why is this person acting funny? And that was the biggest help that the hike did, because it kind of forced us to socialize with everyone again.
Yeah.
And that's the point of the Warrior Expeditions program, mm-hmm. is that reintegration. So they send up like community support stops where you come into town, you talk to like a local VFW or some just random people that have decided to support the program. And the point of that is to get you talking, to realize like, oh, okay, it's fine. I can talk to strangers now. It's it's safe. And really the trail shows you the good in people, mm-hmm. because I think you get a very jaded experience after being in the military and having that experience that you start to believe the worst in people. But on the trail, you truly see that people are inherently good, in that all of this noise that we get from like large
social media,
media outlets like that.
We're all a little traumatized by that.
Exactly. So you see true kindness out on the trail, mm-hmm. where people that are just random strangers give you the keys to their car so you can run down to the grocery store to get some food. Yeah, it really is incredible.
So tell me about how you heard about this program and got into it, because it's like on the other mm-hmm. side of the country from where we were at.
Oh, yeah. So I grew up in Georgia, and mm-hmm. you know, obviously I knew about the Appalachian Trail because that's where it starts. And I was doing section hikes on the AT whenever I could get a break from college. Like if I had a 3-day weekend, 4-day weekend, whatever, I'd be up in the mountains hiking. Mm-hmm. And I was just reading everything Appalachian Trail related. And one day I saw that this Marine was through hiking the trail, and he was raising money for adapted vehicles for people who had lost limbs. Mm-hmm. And after that, I noticed that he wanted to found this program called Warrior Hike, which is what it was at the beginning, because they only did the Appalachian Trail. And that was something that I saw. I read about it. I saw they were sponsoring combat veterans to hike long-distance trails, specifically the AT at that time. And I just kind of put that in the back of my mind as an option for maybe down the road.
So when you say sponsoring, obviously taking 6 months out of your life and just hiking, unless you're independently wealthy, money's got to come from somewhere, right?
Absolutely. And one of the ways, or there's several ways that they support the veterans that are hiking these trails. They provide all of the gear. So all of your gear is 100% sponsored. Mm-hmm. And then they also have community supporters along the trail, which is what I had mentioned previously. So these are just people that have decided to align themselves with the program that take the hikers in. They'll give you some food, let you shower, you know, transport you to and from the trail.
Nice.
It's awesome. Yeah, such wonderful people. And then finally, they do give you a food stipend as well. So, you know, if you're really hankering for a cheeseburger when you get into town, or just whatever has the most calories, you've got a little bit of extra cash in your pocket to do so.
So did you guys just have to put your stuff in storage and like get rid of your apartment for 6 months?
Exactly.
Wow. Which is like, you're at that age where you can do that. And I've talked to folks, you know, well, I'm going to ride my bike across age or I'm going to do something, and I think, could I ever do that? No, I've got a mortgage, I've got kids, I can't do that. But you can do that because at the point of life you're at, right, Wella?
Yeah, I think we were very fortunate that we both separated from the military the same year.
Mm-hmm.
So we reached a point where we had to figure out, do we want to continue along the path of the job that we learned in the military, or is there something else that we want to do in our adult life?
Mm-hmm.
And since both of us were in our mid and late 20s, it was still a great time to kind of figure that out. So not only was this hike for us a time to bond together and heal from the things that we experienced during our military career, but it was also an opportunity to revamp and figure out, where do we want to go from here?
Yeah.
But this is still the first quarter of our life. Where else do we want to go?
You get all these hours of walking to think about things, right?
Yes.
Is that part of the therapy aspect of this, is just quiet time?
Absolutely.
Yes.
I think one of the benefits is throughout majority of the Appalachian Trail, you don't have a lot of cell service.
Mm-hmm.
So you're essentially forced to deal with yourself and whatever thoughts pop up in your brain while you're walking. And I think Justin put it really well, how we kind of like dealt with things as they came up.
Oh, yeah. You just kind of put them away towards later because you don't have time for it in the Army. Even when you're in a non-deployment environment, the operation tempo is so high that you really don't have time to process what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
So when we came back, we had things transitioned very quickly when I returned from Afghanistan. I was out of the Army in 2 months after getting back, starting a new job. And then within 3 months, 3 to 4 months after that, we set foot on the Appalachian Trail. So things were moving at 1,000 miles an hour. And when we finally got there, we were able to process things. And that was the point of the program that Sean Gobin really found was helpful, is that people are able to take these memories, take them out, process them, deal with them, and then put them back in as something that's just kind of,
I would think, like, you guys doing it together would be important too. I mean, if I've done hiking on my own, and you can think all about a lot of stuff, but being able to talk about it is really important too.
Absolutely.
Right? You must have had some really heavy conversations.
Oh yeah, I mean, when we weren't complaining about the hiking and the pain, but yeah, it was great because once again, we had somebody there that understood it. And usually if one of us was having a bad day, the other person was doing okay. So you could pick each other up as you went down the trail.
Mm-hmm. So a veteran who wants to do this, would you recommend they do it with a buddy or do it alone?
I would not recommend they do it with a buddy. the reason why I say that is because one of the big things about the trail that they always say is hike your own hike. And it's especially important for warrior expeditions because you don't want to become necessarily, I don't want to say attached, but you don't want to have to start sharing schedules and things like that, because it happens naturally out on the trail where your pace will link up with the pace of other people and you start to develop what they'll call a trail family there. And I would say it probably causes a little bit of stress if you're not married or in a serious relationship.
If you're forced to be together.
Yeah.
Did you guys, I mean, for you, honestly, did you run into a little marital conflict in this? Because, like, you must have a really good relationship if you didn't.
Well, so it was funny you should bring that up, because a lot of people spoke with us prior to the trail and basically told us we were doomed and we would certainly get a divorce after this trail, because it was just not possible to live together in such close proximity, being so smelly and stinky for 6 months.
Yeah.
But I think there are two things that really helped us. One, we never shared any food. So that means we each individually carried our own food. And
oh, wow.
The reason why this is important is, as you're hiking, anywhere from 15 to 20 miles a day, your hunger, or they call it your hiker hunger, just goes up really high.
Yeah.
You're consuming upwards to 4,000 calories a day.
Mm-hmm.
And we found if we individually carried our own food and didn't have to share, there were never any arguments about the last Snickers bar or who ate that. And that saved a lot of...
It's like having individual bank accounts, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. We had to do that. And then the other thing that really helped us is, although we started and ended at the same place every day, we still hiked our own hike. So Justin, for example, is a faster hiker than I am. I hike at the same speed whether I'm going uphill or downhill, and he is like a rocket going uphill and would usually wait for me at the top, but it would give us an opportunity to spend time alone with our thoughts, because even though it's great to be able to talk together, it's really important. We each have our own experiences. It's important that you can process those on your own.
Yeah.
And I think having that opportunity to hike alone for sometimes it was half an hour, sometimes it was an hour on the trail, was really beneficial to us.
Cool, yeah. So I'm talking to Justin and Wella Jay. They are combat veterans who served just pretty recently in Afghanistan. And then they hiked the entire Appalachian Trail from Georgia to Maine as a way of dealing with the memories and sort of getting back into civilian life. And there's a program called Warrior Expeditions that helps veterans do that. And I bet there are a lot of veterans who listen to our show who could probably benefit from it. So even without doing the entire Appalachian Trail, there's something beneficial about being outdoors.
Absolutely.
And I think I'm not a veteran, but I feel it all the time. You know, I going cross-country skiing at the end of the day, feeling that stress sort of relax and sort of get out there and like realize, okay, all this stuff isn't as important as I think it is. Do you still doing outdoor stuff, and do you still feel that therapeutic part of it?
Oh, absolutely. We still get out on the weekends. Mm-hmm. I've done a lot of overnight trips the last couple weeks, and Wella is actually coming up on a longer hike herself as well.
What do you have planned?
I'll be hiking the Colorado Trail starting next month.
So gosh.
It's from Denver to Durango, and this is, Justin has done solo experiences before, mm-hmm. and that's something that is new to me. So after having built my confidence a little bit and hiking the Appalachian Trail and feeling like I can survive in the outdoors, now it's my turn to hike on my own and see how that feels. And honestly, I'm terrified, but I think I'll be okay. And he's been really supportive through the whole process.
So yeah.
This will be good.
What do you think it is about outdoors or nature that makes this so therapeutic? And we talked before we started a little bit about, you know, people who are having psychological or emotional problems due to trauma. You know, what do? We have to do talk therapy. We talk to a counselor and often take drugs. And this is like sort of the exact opposite of that, right? Because mm-hmm. here you're just sort of like going out on your own and you're just sort of dealing with things yourself. But talk a little bit about how you feel, why do you think this works, or why this is maybe for some people more beneficial than the traditional way to go?
Well, I think it simplifies everything. Mm. I mean, it makes your life very simple because all you're concentrated on is where am I putting my next step? Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. got to make sure I don't fall over the log. So it really breaks it down. And I mean, we came from the woods, so it's really like going home mm-hmm. for humans, really. And I think there's just a certain peace that comes with nature. Everything quiets down. Your cell phone's not ringing. You're not worrying about your boss. It just really brings you back to, I guess, what matters, I would say, in life. You really get clarity while you're out there. And I'm not sure if you've had anything, Wella, that you think has helped you especially.
So I know something that they spoke to us about prior to going on the trail was that one thing that seems to help people and veterans a lot is the natural cycle of the sunlight. So when you're hiking, you go to sleep when the sun sets. You wake up when the sun rises. They call 8 or 9 p.m. hiker midnight because everyone goes to bed because there's no more light.
Right.
And sleep issues are a big problem for a lot of people coming back from deployment. So just getting the right amount of sleep in itself helps you think clearer and puts your mind in a state where you can start processing all the different thoughts and experiences that you've had. And I think hiking in some way puts you in a little bit of a meditative state where you really are in a quiet space and can process all the different thoughts that you've had. And you might also reach a point of clarity where you know, okay, I've dealt with a majority of these experiences, but maybe I do need some additional talk therapy. But now you've been able to identify what you need because you've had a quiet area to process everything. Mm-hmm. So at no point are we discounting the effect of medication. We just think that something like nature therapy, going on a hike, riding your bicycle, paddling down a river, is a lot more empowering and actually gives you the feeling that you're doing something for your health versus depending on a pill that is taking care of it for mm-hmm. you.
And then you're just trying to spread the word and let other people know that hey, this really works.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And I think maybe Justin can speak a little bit more on how Warrior Expeditions has expanded because they offer a lot more than just hiking on the Appalachian Trail nowadays.
Okay.
Maybe also a little about the application process.
Yeah. And we'll have all those resources at outdoorexplorer.org. Just click on today's show and we have some photos, hopefully, of your track. Yeah, we'll put that up and we'll have the link to learn more about this program. But go ahead and tell more about the program.
So they've expanded to offer long-distance hikes on other trails. So the Pacific Crest Trail has been included, the Continental Divide Trail. So you've got the Triple Crown right there, the AT, the CDT, and the PCT. They also offer regional hikes for people who don't have time to take 6 months out of their life. So they do state trails like the Buckeye Trail, the Ice Age Trail, the Mountains to Sea Trail. They also offer a paddling option, so now they're doing Warrior Paddle, and you canoe down the Mississippi. Mm-hmm. And then there's also Warrior Bike, where you bicycle across America. So they really have opened up several different options for vets.
And this is an opportunity for combat veterans.
That's correct.
Yeah. And it's an opportunity where you're not being able asked to pay for something. It's being supplied as essentially a charity for folks who want to support veterans.
That's correct.
Right. Great. Well, and I know a lot of people are going to find out about it. Anything else to add before we finish up?
Oh, maybe we could just talk about some of the resources here in Alaska for mm-hmm. people that are interested.
Absolutely.
So obviously, Warrior Expeditions is available to people all over the United States. The only thing that you are required to fund is your plane ticket to and from the trail, whichever trail you end up going on. Mm-hmm. Some local organizations that we have here that people might not be aware of is Alaska Healing Hearts. They offer a lot of outdoor therapy and funded hunting trips as well. And I know that our local VA also offers other therapy activities. They do yoga. We have a Transcendental Meditation Center here in Alaska as well. Mm-hmm. So they're just other options that are available here in the state as well if someone wanted immediate assistance and maybe doesn't have the opportunity to take 6 months off.
And I guess I get the feeling from talking to you guys that it's not just somebody who's like in a horrible psychological crisis who needs this kind of support. Mm-hmm. It's kind of anybody who's been through these experiences really should take some time, get outdoors, and sort of work through it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's also, although, you know, we're combat veterans and this is what we spoke about primarily for military mm-hmm. personnel, I think anyone would benefit yeah. from this because we all have experiences that we need to work through. And mm-hmm. even if it's just a long weekend hike that you have, or you can go for a long fishing trip, any time spent in nature where you're away from the noise of social media and the news is time well spent.
Absolutely. Well, thanks so much for coming in. I've been talking with Justin and Wella Jay, who are veterans, and we always say thank you for your service. And it's true. It's like such a cliche, but I think we really feel it, especially here in Alaska. So thank you for serving our country, and thanks for telling about this great program. It's terrific.
Thank you so much.
Okay, yeah, thanks for having us.
Stick with us as Outdoor Explorer continues.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
This next piece is a bit unusual for us, but it's funny and weird and about our sister state, Hawaii. Radio producer Scott Carrier went there a decade ago to get surf lessons, but he did it without knowing what he's getting into and without having even the most basic preparations. He got an intense cross-cultural experience.
I always wanted to learn how to surf. Surfing is the only sport with its own music. Baseball has the Wurlitzer organ, and football has the marching band, but surf music actually describes the thing itself. I love surf music, and for a long time, I thought I could learn to surf just by listening to the music alone. Like the Mermen, my favorite group, a bass, a drummer, a lead guitar. They became my teachers, and I learned a great deal from them. I walked around, ate, slept, and worked with Jim Thomas's Liquid Reverb stuck in my head like a cosmic mantra. But there came a point this last summer when I realized my study could go no farther, and in order to progress, I'd actually have to get wet. So I went online and found a surf school on the web. It was in the surf mecca of the world, the North Shore of Oahu, and the advertisement said that the students camped out on the beach, right next to the ocean. It seemed perfect, so I signed up. No questions asked. But when I got there to the campground on the northern tip of the island, I realized the school was not what I expected. I was the only student, and there wasn't even a surfboard for me to use. My instructor, a full-blooded Hawaiian named Miles Apuakehau, was there putting up a big tent, and he was really pissed off, driving wooden stakes into the sand with a sledgehammer like he was going to send them to the center of the earth. Miles was an experienced surfer and the vice president of the North Shore Surf Club, the Hui, but this was his first day working as an instructor, and he was thinking about quitting right then and there. He said the woman who ran the school, his boss, knew nothing about surfing or running a business. All she knew how to do was make a website. And she was really cheap. She told him not to eat any of the good food, the expensive food, as that was just for me. He said, she wants me to eat Spam. I don't need this shit. Let her teach you how to surf. Another thing I didn't expect was that I had a hard time understanding Miles when he spoke. I didn't know that Hawaiians, or at least some Hawaiians, speak with a thick accent, dropping off parts of words, using other words I'd never heard.
I'm the guy in the water. I can stand on the beach, I can tell you some stuff. That's why he came down here. You out there, you know where he was smiling, nobody, and we're like, who's this guy? Unless you get a nice, you know, rolling wave and when you break the top third of the wave and you just keep on going. That's Kahana be kind, but you rarely find places like that.
Did you get that? Neither did I, at least in the beginning. Miles was a trip. Dark skin, huge shoulders, intense fiery eyes like Miles Davis. Not at all the image of the happy Hawaiian I had fixed in my mind. He was pissed off at a lot more than his boss.
Yeah, I cannot trust a white guy as far as I can spit, actually. Yeah. Everybody's changed with the time. Or they just give you the cold shoulder. But if they like be like that, that's his loss.
I thought about getting upset, but then I realized I was in Hawaii, and the air smelled like flowers, and the ocean was 100 feet away, and Miles was putting up this large tent, like a Bedouin shelter, made from sheets of heavy plastic and poles of ironwood he'd cut down, tied with knots I'd never seen before, using golf balls to hold the plastic so it wouldn't rip out in the wind, and the tent would be a good home. Plus, he had this very strange bicycle leaning against a tree. The frame was from a kid's BMX bicycle, but the forks were from a 10-speed, and it had a big machete hanging down from the seat to the pedals, a toolkit on the back rack that included channel locks, socket wrenches, and a drawing compass. Looking at that bike and the tent, I knew that while Miles may have some issues, he was still the real thing, a surfer, not a bum, but somebody who'd figured out how to live close to the land, close to the things that made him truly happy. And I felt lucky to have him as my instructor. Besides Miles, there was his girlfriend, Daylin Vickery, whose official job was to take care of the camp. But really, she was more like my interpreter. Not for Miles, but to explain Hawaiian culture to me.
To be Hawaiian is a state of mind. Anybody can be Hawaiian at heart. You know? Hawaiians, they love to love. They like simple. They like smooth. They like to rise with the tide, go with the flow. You can see a Hawaiian from far away by the way they walk. Look at Miles, how he walks. His back is straight. He walks straight. He look at you straight in the eye. He doesn't turn away when you look at him. I don't turn away when we speak to you. When you speak to us, we look you straight in the face. So we can see what kind of person you are. Yeah, I think people are people all over the world. But I think Hawaiians are desperately trying to hold on with what little we have left of our Hawaiian-ness. We're so conditioned to live the white man way because it was rammed down our throats. They mostly take and we mostly give. And I think that's where the animosity and that's where the generations of anger, deep down anger, come from. But luckily for us, we invented surfing, and that's awesome.
Although the woman who ran the school didn't have a surfboard for me to use, she did give me a windsurfing board, which was kind of like a surfboard, except that it had a sandpaper surface on top that Miles said was going to give me a rash. I didn't care. I just wanted to get in the water. So the first day, we went down to the beach and sat there looking out at the waves. I thought Miles was going to give me a long, sort of philosophical lecture on how to do it, But all he said was, watch out for the Portuguese men of war and don't turn your back on the ocean. That was it. I tried to follow him as he paddled out, but I got stung by a man of war about 20 feet from the beach. And while I was flailing around trying to get it off my leg, a wave broke on top of me and sent me to the floor, where my board flew up in the air and then came back down on my head. The first thing I noticed once I got going was that paddling was hard. The windsurfing board was heavy and awkward, and the wind was blowing me back to the beach, and the current was taking me down the shoreline, and my arms felt like toothpicks in the water. Plus, it was hard to hold my head up off the board. I was using muscles I didn't really have. And then, I'd say within the first half hour, that 80 grit on top of the board tore the skin off my chest. It hurt. Salt water does not feel good on abrasions. I spent about 2 hours in the water, and all I did was flail around and get thrashed by the waves, my arms and legs pulled from their sockets, water rammed down my throat like I had my mouth around a fire hose. Pretty pathetic. I crawled up on the beach and lay there like a sick puppy. The next day, I refused to go back out on the windsurfing board. It was too cruel. My chest was like raw hamburger. So we hitchhiked into town, and Miles got his longboard out of a friend's garage. It was beautiful. It must have been worth about $1,000. I was worried I was going to mess it up and said I'd rather just rent a cheap board somewhere. But Miles insisted, saying it was the perfect board for me because it was easy to paddle and stand up on. And he was right. It made all the difference in the world. I was able to follow Miles and watch what he was doing, and that was all it took, just watching what he did. No need for talking, just do it. Get out there in the right place, sit up on the board looking out at the waves coming in, wait until you see a big one coming. Then turn the board around and lie down so your hands are on the sides, about right in the middle. Keep looking back at the wave. It either breaks before it gets to you, smashing on top of you, and all of a sudden you're in a blender set on pulverized, or it doesn't break at all and just passes you by, or it comes up like a living being, like it should have a name, and you know it's there for you. So you paddle hard, and the thing picks you up and throws you forward. The board is shaking. You're strapped onto a rocket and just want to hold on, but you've got to stand up quickly. Push up and jump to the center of the board. Feet spread out, knees bent, and ride the thing. Look back, try to stay on the edge of the whitewash. I made a lot of mistakes, but I did do it right a number of times. Stood up and got some good rides. And man, I'm telling you, it felt good. To be honest, the waves where we were at were not that big. Maybe 5 feet at the highest, measured from the front, but just right for learning. And the water was amazing. Not cold at all, luminescent, iridescent blue and green, like it was lit from below. It was clean. Do the drill. That's the only word I can think of. Clean like Jim Thomas's guitar, clean like fresh powder snow, clean like a cold morning in the desert. Every cell in my body was happy. After a couple days surfing there at the beach where we were camped, I asked Miles if we could go find some bigger waves, but he said there weren't really any bigger waves right then, that it was the wrong season, no storms coming in, and anyway, it was better for me to learn on this beach, where there weren't any rocks or coral or dangerous wave actions.
But it's better that you learn on something like this, because these guys begin to learn off of surfing. They go out, and they come surfing, resurfing, and these guys, they get slammed, I mean, you know. These guys catch a wave and they go straight down, hit the bottom of the reef, you know, hit the top of the reef under the water, pick up some strawberries on the side. Not to mention, you know, the board might whack them. They freaking gasping for air. Maybe get up and a local guy come over there pound him because he dropped in and he f***ed up the wave. Look how much stuff went happen to the guy. And he's just trying to learn. Okay, so jump out of the water and go home, sell a surf bar that. So you're going to learn. No, go where you think you can. Go where you No, you can't, because accidents happen, attitude getting hurt. Don't worry about it. If you don't get hurt, you can get hurt. Nothing you can do about it. It's like destiny.
One day we went fishing with Miles throw net. He didn't catch anything, but I got to spend the whole day staring into the water, looking for fish, which in my book is what it's all about anyway. The light in Hawaii is like a drug, the kind of thing you can feel going into your body and changing your chemistry, the kind of thing that makes you sick when you leave. All in all, I had a great time. I wouldn't really recommend the surfing school. I won't even mention it by name, but I would recommend Miles as a teacher. He doesn't talk much about surfing, but you can learn a lot by watching him. One other thing I learned, Hawaiians don't listen to surf music. I asked Daylin if she'd ever heard of the Mermen, and she said, "The who?" She said on Hawaii they listen to Hawaiian music, like Brother Is. Israel Kamaka Wiwaole, a 500-pound man who played the ukulele. He died young in 1997 due to complications of his enormous size. All Hawaiians truly love the man because of his big heart. They still cry when they hear his music. It's not at all like surf music, not at all what I expected, but some trips are like that. For the Savvy Traveler, this is Scott Carrier.
That was producer Scott Carrier coming to us through the Public Radio Exchange, PRX. This is Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm Charles Wolforth.
Well, I see trees of green and red roses too. I watch them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself.
Our final story today comes from Africa. Burke Betts describes himself as an enthusiastic hiker, a poor skier, and a full-time grover. His weaknesses have never stopped him from diving in headfirst into a challenge, especially when it's an outdoor adventure with friends. He grew up in Wainwright and Quiguilinoc, and his work is taking him from Arctic Alaska to rural Zululand. This story comes from the Trail Tales storytelling event.
I swear we were playing whiskey slaps, or at least I thought so. Someone convinced me that it was true. I recognize a few faces. Some of you would recognize me, but I'm an occasional NSA ski bear, so I usually can't see you. Only occasional. I've tried to lobby for a permanent gig, but Tamara has not yet granted it to me. I'm also a pedestrian skier and a very avid hiker. I found out that I was headed to East Africa last year, so I decided I should invite some friends and climb Kilimanjaro. And we're usually pretty active out here in the Front Range all summer, all winter. My friends joke that they kind of don't need a bear bell when they're with me because I'm just loud enough on my own. And I also have kind of great will, not great skills, but definitely great will. So as soon as I got into good fitness with all my good hiking friends, I started to, whenever possible, leave them behind me and show them who's boss by getting up the hill first. And so I brought this great repertoire to East Africa, to Kilimanjaro, with four of my closest friends. After some bungled travel arrangements, a beach vacation, which we decided to do before climbing the mountain, we headed up to Kilimanjaro, and the first day, we walked through a lovely forest, not too aggressive hiking. There were just monkeys off in the side. It was a really compelling scenery. Our second day, we popped up onto this plateau. The sun was beating down. My Alaskan blood and skin was not handling all that sunlight well. So I struggled up. It's only the second day. And as soon as I got to our campsite, I went up to the water jug where I was to wash my hands, and I pulled out a bandana, washed it, covered it in water, threw it on my face, and laid down in the dirt as I was ready for some sleep before dinner. And I was woken up by one of our guides who said to me, "Burke, you're going to get sick. Don't sleep under the sun like that." And I also found out later that the water I had been bathing my bandana in and placing on my face was the only water not purified on our trip. But we'll get to that soon enough. I ate dinner, had a good time with the friends that night, and then we all went to sleep. And I remember waking up really early in the morning, and I sat up, and the first thing I did was just threw up. Luckily, I had my buff, so I vomited into my buff as I left my tent, kept my clothes clean, aside from the buff. It was a Tour of Anchorage buff, so represent. And I decide, well, it's probably just altitude sickness. I'd better eat breakfast. So I eat breakfast, and I survey the camp. I pack up my things, and there's a trail leading out of camp. There's about probably 200 people camped at that site that night. And everyone is kind of in a similar stage, getting ready to depart. And there's a natural bottleneck as you get to this this path. And as my friends and I hike towards that path, we get there, and immediately I throw up again, just all over the trail and really loudly. I'm feeling really horribly at this point, and I've decided maybe it's not altitude, or maybe the altitude is worse than I thought it was. And my friends, they look at me, and a grave look of concern, like, Burke, why is your vomit blue? It's still kind of a mystery why it is. I never really stopped to think about it. I was just concerned that I was vomiting. And so it quickly became clear that I was not going to be able to keep up with my friends, which, with my competitive nature, was not a very happy thought. But I'm saying to myself, well, at least one of these guides is going to walk with me. We'll take a shorter route. I'll get some rest along the way. And so we started our hike, probably the easiest hike of the climb up Kilimanjaro. And about halfway through, I'm really struggling. I can't drink any water. I can't eat anything. My stomach is so upset. And every time my guide tells me, drink some water, I try, and then I immediately throw up. So by the time I'm halfway through, I'm done. And I pass this this road, and I'm like, why is there a road halfway up Kilimanjaro? It's like, oh, that's the escape road. That's for ambulances. I'm like, ah, good to know, good to know. This may come in handy. And we pass it, and I'm just thinking to myself, I'm struggling. I don't know if I'm going to make this. And I literally sit down every 15 minutes, and I fall asleep on the side of the trail. And this poor guide wakes me up every 15 minutes. Time to hike 10 more minutes before you can fall asleep again. And I'm dehydrated. I haven't had anything that stayed in my stomach since the night before. I struggle up to this camp. My friends still aren't there yet because they've taken an acclimatization hike. And I get there, and this woman is kind of walking up alongside me, and she looks at me, and she just stops and, like, stares, like, are you all right? I'm like, I think so. So I keep on hiking. I immediately just sit down in our kitchen tent, and I promptly fall asleep in a chair for 3 hours until I'm woken up by my friends. My friends arrive, and there's one extra person in our group, a non-Alaskan, who's a doctor, and he looks at me. And he takes one look, and he's like, you need an IV. We need to get you off this mountain. You need medical attention. And my friends are like, oh no, like Burke helped put this trip together. Like, we can't lose him now. And so they're trying to encourage me. And I'm suffering. Like, I'm not even looking up at this point. Like, they're just like sitting, talking around me, and I'm half asleep. I'm dehydrated. I haven't drank or ate anything in 24 hours at this point. And so I say to the guides myself, can you take me down? Like, I think I'm done climbing. They're like, no, perhaps tomorrow. So then I'm like, well, I'll talk to the doctor one more time. I'm like, would you please tell them that I might die if I don't get off this mountain? And so he goes, very thoughtful doctor, and tells these guides, we do need to take him off. And they said, no, give him one more night. So I collapse in my tent. I bring this giant bowl in case I have to throw up. My poor friend comes into the tent later that night and, like, realizes he's sleeping next to me in my vomit bowl. Not enthused. And I wake up in the morning, and I haven't had anything to eat or drink, so I'm dehydrated, but I haven't vomited, so I'm feeling sort of all right, but I've got this aching headache. My stomach is still just really struggling, and my friend asks me, are you going to make it? Are you going to keep hiking? And I tell him no. And he's like, well, you should at least try to eat some breakfast. I'm like, get away from me. Stop talking to me. So again, I'm this usually like loud, enthusiastic, very sometimes aggressive hiker. And I've decided I'm not going to talk to anyone. I'm going down the mountain until I get the scent of some pancakes. And then I'm like, well, just one, just one. And the pancakes seem to breathe some life into me because I'm ready to go through with this hike after all. But the second day was almost as bad as that first day. As I'm hiking, and again, I'm the loud one, and my friends are trying to learn Swahili words. They're trying to count 1 through 10 over and over again because they're messing up at like number 8 every time. And I'm just like, stop it, stop it. Like, going towards the back as far as I can to get away from them, worried that I'm going to throw up, I'm going to shoot out diarrhea, any end, who knows? This is horrible. About halfway through the hike, we get to this mountain spot called Lava Tower. We're at the end of the plateau where I got sick, the Shira Plateau. And I'm like, you know, I think I'm ready for my first meal. Surprisingly, it stayed down. And from there on, I made a pretty full recovery. Fast forward 2 days, we're at base camp. We've got 7,000 more feet to hike. We're going to do it in one night. I'm going to get up to the summit under cover of darkness before the winds pick up, before the light brings out all the dust. I'm feeling great now. But my friends are now feeling the effects of altitude sickness. I'm probably feeling it too, but I'm like, I've already been through the worst. Nothing's going to stop me. My friends are really suffering. And our guide is like, you guys ready to go? I'm like, yep. Now I've got all the energy. And we start hiking up. There's probably 20, 25 groups ahead of us, and we proceed to pass throughout the course of this night, at least probably half of them, because I'm right on the right behind the guide. Every time we stop, and like, we're ready to go again. We're ready to go again. And my friends just like, can see them looking up at me like through the dark, like, why is he doing this? And we literally like have a guy, some guides like standing right behind, like keeping people from falling every other step. And I'm like, let's go, let's go. And surprisingly, we all made it up. We summited Kilimanjaro, and it was a struggle of a way down for all of us, I think, and especially for those who were sick with altitude. And from there on out, I did not get the chance to hike with another one of those friends for 4 months. So beware. Have mercy on your friends as they will have mercy on you, and definitely beware anyone who vomits blue.
That was Burke Betts speaking at Trail Tales, the event put on by Alaska Trails. You can learn more about them and all our guests at outdoorexplorer.org. Earlier in today's show, we heard it from Justin and Wella Jay talking about Warrior Expeditions and their hike of the Appalachian Trail, and then we heard Scott Carrier's piece about his ill-fated surfing adventures in Hawaii. That's all for today's show. Eric Bork's our producer, Hannah Duro's our assistant producer. My name is Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.